giving a big shout out to all of the people that I left tonight that were at the Charles Dickens dinner, the Dickens dinner, big fundraiser I got to host. That was fun. And I was just getting caught up on football. When I left before I went over for this auction over at a lovely cathedral, I had a chance to watch some of the Alabama-Florida SEC championship game. And Alabama was beating Florida, but I didn't think there's any way they could end up holding them off, but they did. It was awesome. I always like to cheer for the underdogs, so that was pretty cool. Knocked off number one Florida. And then I saw Tim Tebow on the sideline crying. He was like sniffling and crying. You can't do no. Can't give a Heisman Trophy to a guy who cries because he loses. I can't do that. Can't get so used to winning that you don't even can't even process it when you lose. I hope my eyes were deceiving me. Your ears will not be deceiving you tonight. This is going to be one of those shows that will contain a bunch of shut up, get out kind of moments. The material in Russ Baker's book is either true or not. I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt here and say that Family of Secrets, the Bush Dynasty, America's Invisible Government, and the Hidden History of the Last 50 Years is so well attributed. It is so well sourced. I can't remember any of the sources that didn't go by name. I'm sure that I've just kind of skipped over them, but I mean, everybody has gone on the record with their own personal reflection on both the Bush dynasty in the United States and the people that are behind it, the true power brokers in this country, the people who are accountable to nobody but themselves, the unelected who are extremely powerful. Now, that may not come as a shock to anybody here who's listening to this show, that there are these sort of darker, invisible forces out there that are moving pieces around like some big giant chess game. But to hear some of the things that Russ Baker has been able to look into and confirm, and then also to hear him speculate about how these same forces may be at work, controlling the current administration, the Obama administration. And it'll help explain why lately you're hearing a lot of criticism from people who are saying, what's the difference between President Obama and President Bush? Maybe Russ Baker has the answer for that, and we'll get to that coming up next hour on Coast to Coast. It'll be nice to have Fred Burton back. He's the author of a book called A Ghost, Confessions of a Counterterrorism Agent. We wanted to ask him about the counterterrorism that's going to be needed here to stop more shootings like the one that was at Fort Hood. And so he's going to give us his thoughts on that after years being a special agent in counterterrorism for the U.S. Department of State. We'll do that after we do a little crypto news coming up in just a second, because I don't know if you've heard about that, but nano snowmen and giant blue whales all making the crypto news next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Well, I just checked the website at coasttocoastam.com just to see whether or not Tim had had a chance to update the page yet. Not as of the last time I hit refresh, but at any second, you'll see a photo will pop up here. We took it off somebody else's website. Don't worry, we're giving them credit, but it speaks to something that's in Russ Baker's book. We'll talk to him next hour, Family of Secrets, the Bush Dynasty, America's Invisible Government, and the Hidden History of the Last 50 Years. Did you see the photo of the person that looks just like George Bush, Herbert Walker Bush, in Dealey Plaza, the day of the assassination? Now, I say just like it. It's a little blurry. We'll get the photo up and you'll see what I'm talking about in just a second. But wouldn't it be weird if three future presidents of the United States had all been in Dallas the day of the JFK assassination? That would be Richard Nixon, George Herbert Walker Bush, and LBJ. Now, we know that LBJ was there. It's not a mystery that Richard Nixon was there. He flew out that morning from Dallas. In fact, a story about Richard Nixon was in the headlines the day that Kennedy flew into town. So that's not news. But what about George Herbert Walker Bush? Well, this is one of the very interesting aspects of this book, Family of Secrets, is I never knew this, that George Herbert Walker Bush can't seem to remember where he was the day of the JFK assassination. Russ Baker has proved almost conclusively that he was in Dallas, and that very likely George Bush, 41, was CIA about 13 years before he ever said that he was CIA. In fact, he may have been CIA even longer than that. I throw this out to you only because it's just one of the many new pieces that's in this book. We'll get to it coming up next hour, and we'll put the photo up on our webpage in just a moment, so keep looking for that. While you go past that, you can see the great balloon hunt. That's up there, too, top of the fold on the web at coasttocoastam.com. That's a little gift from our folks over at DARPA. We were talking about DARPA a few weeks ago, right? That's the scientific agency that's really out there coming up with the new and the latest and the weirdest and then finding applications for them later on. Well, DARPA's got a balloon launch. They put that up there. And then, of course, maybe you've seen it already, is the little snowman guy. Have you seen the world's smallest snowman? It's not really a snowman. It's not really made out of snow, but it is a nano snowman. It's kind of all over the web. Experts at the National Physical Laboratory in West London have made this miniature figure. But they didn't, you know, roll the balls or anything like that. They had a special way that they had to do it using a focused ion beam and stuff. But you can look at it. It's kind of cool how they made a little miniature snowman. If you're wondering why it's taken bored scientists this long to create the world's smallest snowman, it's because they only recently abandoned their attempts to grow the world's smallest carrots. But you'll see it if you go to the webpage. And by the way, far from nano figurines created by humans to the world's biggest creatures created by the creator, blue whales are whaling to bluer notes these days. This was a story from physorg.com. All around the world, blue whales aren't singing like they used to, and scientists have no idea why. The largest animals on Earth are singing in ever deeper voices every year. Among the suggested explanations are ocean noise pollution, changing population dynamics, new mating strategies. None of them is entirely convincing. Quote, we don't have the answer. We just have a lot of recordings, said Mark McDonald, president of Whale Acoustics. Now, it started about 8 years ago in every ocean all over the world. What could that mean? Doesn't look like global warming is the answer. Maybe it's that 2012 thing. You know, maybe the whales are trying to signal that large black cylindrical object floating over our planet. Or maybe the whales are singing lower just to get their berry white funk on before time runs out in 2012. Or maybe they sing lower to attract plankton. Krilling me softly with his song. Krilling me. Anyway, whales are not the only ones that eat plankton, so to speak. So do plants. Maybe we should call that plankton. Scientists from the Royal Botanic Gardens are saying that carnivorous behavior in plants is far more widespread than previously thought, with many commonly grown plants like petunias at least partway to being meat eaters. Petunias. Carnivorous plants have caught the imagination of humans since ancient times. Obviously, they fit well into the Victorian interest in Gothic horror stories. Accounts of man-eating plants published in the 19th century works have long since been discredited. But carnivorous plants fascinated Charles Darwin, and he and his friend Sir Joseph Hooker had an extensive correspondence concerning those. So Hooker had an interest in this, so did Darwin. Since Darwin's time, several groups have been generally recognized as carnivorous plants. So you got your Venus flytraps, pitcher plants, that kind of a thing. Various other plants have been suggested as possible carnivores by some authors, but some of that's being debated. For example, petunias and potatoes have sticky hairs that trap insects. And some species of campion have the common name catchfly for the same reason. However, they don't necessarily eat their prey, or at least they haven't been able to figure out whether or not they're absorbing the breakdown of the products. Professor Mark Chase, keeper of the Jodrell Laboratory at the Royal Botanic Gardens, says, although a man-eating tree is fictional, many commonly grown plants may turn out to be cryptic carnivores, at least by absorbing through their roots the breakdown products of the animals they ensnare. Kind of cool. He says, we may be surrounded by many more murderous plants than we think. Isn't that the plot of the Happening, that movie? Or at least the so-called plot of that movie? What I remember before I fell asleep? Scary. I had no idea my petunias were looking at me like I'm some kind of pork chop with pants on. As much time as I spend working on my lawn, maybe it's time I should have some artificial meat in my pocket to fend them off. And that's coming. Scientists from Eindhoven University in the Netherlands have for the first time grown pork meat in the laboratory by extracting cells from a live pig and growing them in a petri dish. The scientist extracted myoblast cells from a living pig and grew them in a solution of nutrients derived from the blood of animal fetuses, not feti, as long as the final product looks and tastes like meat. The lead scientist says he's convinced that people will buy it. At present, the product is a sticky, soggy, unappetizing muscle mass. But the team is seeking ways to exercise and stretch the muscles to turn the product into meat of a more familiar consistency for sales eventually in countries like America. And I say, what? I thought they'd been selling this for years. I'm pretty sure that I ate soggy, laboratory-raised, unappetizing muscle mass in every dorm cafeteria I lived in college. You sure this is new? We'll keep you updated. Finally, are you getting into the holiday spirit? Are nano snowmen not enough? Well, local charities around the country are suffering this year for two main reasons, the economy and the weather. Obviously, many more people would like to be in a place where they are giving and not receiving, but we still aren't there yet. The weather has been a problem in many parts of the country because it hasn't looked like nor felt like December. Donations to food banks, Toys for Tots, Salvation Army, many other Christmas season dependent charities are way, way down. So in exchange for considering if you can dig a little bit deeper and help out, I will share a little bit of holiday cheer. A photo taken the other night in front of the Minnesota governor's mansion with my son Itchy and my good friend Judge Mary Pawlenty, the first lady, the wife of Governor Tim Pawlenty, who's maybe running for president in 2012. Yes, he is. You know, he might be. Yes, he is. I hope it helps to get you in the holiday mood and or thinking about Christmas. So I'll post this little picture right now. It's online on my blog at coasttocoastam.com. If you scroll down to the bottom, there's a little holiday picture. Maybe it'll make you smile. It makes me smile. And so does the work of Fred Burton. You got to like it, Fred, when you put out a book like your book, Ghost, Confessions of a Counterterrorism, Counterterrorism Agent. I don't have it here in front of me. Did I get that right, Fred?
Yes, you did.
Okay. And then you put that out, and then just then, of course, we all become sort of newly interested in some of the aspects of the work of counter-terrorist experts like yourself to try to stop more attacks like we sadly had at Fort Hood just a little while ago. So thank you for coming back on the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, Ian. Thank you for having me on.
Okay. So this is interesting because as a counterterrorism agent for many years, you're now in private practice, but for doing it for many years, you know, you were kind of pioneering this at a time when there really wasn't a roadmap for how one does counterterrorism. Can you explain that?
Yes. I first got in this business in the early 80s, and it was like pushing a boulder up a hill, to be blunt, which I talk about in my book, Ghost. And you could actually see this kind of threat emerging all around the globe. And of course, we did not have the resources at the time to do anything about it, and we were trying to do the best we could. I was one of the first three counterterrorism agents. And then if you fast forward here to the carnage at Fort Hood, it's just a horrendous tragedy. And I'm afraid that we did have some balls dropped. I think that we do need a congressional inquiry into this, and I'm a bit amazed that we've already had one on the White House party crashers, but we've not had any congressional inquiry into the shooting at Fort Hood.
Right. Well, if it's any consolation, of course, the congressional inquiry into the White House party crashers was pretty much a non-starter. So it's not like they've got a big leg up on an investigation in Fort Hood. And I think that's really, I think actually your work and the stories you tell in Ghost, I think that in a way you could look at it as being sort of prescient. There was a time when people didn't take counterterrorism very seriously. You had advocates, you had people that said, no, we have to do this. And other people were like, well, you know, can't the Army do this, or what's the CIA for, or whatever? And I think in a way we're still there. I mean, there was here you had the Army, and you give me us, you know, your perspective on this, but the Army had emails and phone calls of this guy getting in touch with Major Hassan, getting in touch with Al Qaeda, and they just pretty much looked the other way and said he's not a threat. So, I mean, we get that far. That's a long way from where you started with this in as a counterterrorism agent. And look how far we got, and people still aren't taking it seriously.
And you raise a good point, Ian. I mean, in this year alone at our company, Stratfor, we've looked at 10 plots inside the United States, to include this one at Fort Hood. And if you look at this from a counterterrorism perspective, you had an intelligence case that was opened on this imam in San Diego who had connections to the three of the 9/11 hijackers. And it appears that the FBI did a pretty good job on a FISA with intercepting some email communication from Major Hassan. And that lead was transferred to Washington, where Major Hassan was, to the Joint Terrorism Task Force there. And I'm very familiar with that task force. I was one of the original agents that participated in that. And for whatever reason, it doesn't look like any action was taken. And this is where I have a different theory. I think that I want to give the FBI some credit. I think that they've done a wonderful job here domestically with the Zazi plot in New York, the Smoty plot in Dallas, Texas, where a terrorist was planning to blow up the Wells Fargo building. And I think that they were looking at Major Hassan possibly as a developmental asset, meaning when you get an individual like this that is communicating with a infamous terrorist like this imam, and then you uncover that he's active duty U.S. military, the first thing that you're going to think of in a task force capacity is how can I double him into the organization? And because of the process, it takes 90 days. You get a case opened process-wise in the FBI for 90 days. It's called a preliminary inquiry. And that's where this case drops off the radar. So my theory is that the task force in Washington was looking at Major Hassan as possibly a developmental asset, or trying to determine how can we turn him and play him back in.
Okay, I got to ask you this then, because you put it on the table, and we're talking with Fred Burton, the author of Ghost: Confessions of a Counterterrorism Agent. When we get you back on here in just a minute, I want to just ask you then, how do you know how would any of us ever know if the FBI already had turned him as an agent? And you say they were trying to, and maybe they were trying to develop him. Well, why can't we just make the leap that that's why the FBI didn't act on the fact that he was walking around with a business card on it that listed, you know, his never listed the army, but listed his association with as being a Muslim, and why he was seemed to be so far out in front of his Muslim identity. Is it possible that the FBI thought they had him in his back pocket? We'll come back to that. I'll ask Fred Burton about that. We'll also give the phone numbers, too. Here we're kind of sorting out the shooting at Fort Hood. Before we get to the book Family of Secrets, Russ Baker, very interesting, on the Bush dynasty and the invisible government after the top of the hour at Coast to Coast. So, online, we've got the story up. Good job, Tim. Couldn't have been easy. I messed up his beautiful design just 15 minutes before we went to air by asking him to grab a photo I had seen some time ago, a comparison photo of an obscure shot from the day of the JFK assassination at Dealey Plaza, and a guy which some people said looks a lot like George Herbert Walker Bush. And I kind of filed that away going, oh, that would be weird, although it was Texas, and he's from Texas, but wouldn't that be weird if he was there? And then I'm getting into the book Family of Secrets with Russ Baker. And of course, the question comes up not just whether or not he was there, but why wouldn't he be there if the CIA came to him for a briefing after the JFK assassination? Why would they go to George Herbert Walker Bush? Why? What would he possibly need a briefing? Then the CIA comes up with this really goofy explanation. Well, it wasn't him. It was another George Bush. We'll get to that coming up after the top of the hour. Plus that odd story about George Bush sending a memo to J. Edgar Hoover, tipping him off to somebody in his own office that they ought to look at as being a possible shooter. It sounds bizarre, but it's just part of the book Family of Secrets. It's everything you've ever wondered and things you never even knew about. The Bush family dynasty and the invisible government, the power brokers that put them there and may or may not be already controlling the Obama administration, too. Coming up more on that next hour. But if you go online, you'll see the pictures there. You can click onto my blog, too, and take a look at crypto news if you missed it earlier this hour. And that fun holiday photo at the bottom of the blog for people who are interested. Also, let's get back to this conversation about Fort Hood. Next, Fred Burton, author of Ghost, Confessions of a Counterterrorism Agent. Fred was a counterterrorism agent before anybody even really knew what that was. And yet it still seems like we don't know exactly what to do with it. We gave the numbers out in case you wanted to join the conversation on this, but I want to see where Fred goes with this. How do we know that the FBI wasn't already handling him as an asset or using Hassan is a way to get in with Al Qaeda? Maybe that's why they looked at the case and said, oh, nothing to worry about here, because he was already their guy. We'll find out. We'll ask him, Fred Burton, how could we ever know that? Coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Fred Burton, Ghost, Confessions of a Counterterrorism Agent. So why couldn't we think that maybe Major Hassan had already been turned by the FBI? That's why they let him get away with all the stuff that would, to the rest of us, are going, hey, what about these red flags? Maybe they had that covered.
And when you look at how a JTTF, an FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force, operates, you're after human intelligence, and it's very, very difficult to get. And luckily, our technology edge, our ability to capture these communications in the chat rooms and so forth is giving our edge at this point. The moment we lose that, we're in trouble as a nation. And I think operationally that when you have a source, potential source like this, that's a cleared U.S. Army major, the first thing you're going to want to do is attempt to pitch him and turn him and have him work for you. I know that's what I would have been thinking.
Right. So that makes perfect sense. So let's say they got this guy. He's already reaching out to Al Qaeda. They want to make sure that he gets taken seriously. So they let him keep doing all the weird stuff that he's doing. And, you know, and all the ways in which the rest of us later on go, What do you mean there was no threat to this? Look how obvious the threat is. Maybe that explains why there's no congressional investigation, Fred.
Possibly. And also process-wise, remember, Ian, you've got 90 days. The clock starts ticking once that lead is opened in the field office. So San Diego transfers that to Washington. Washington's got 90 days. And then what we know stops. And the only explanation I have that's logical is that he was opened as an asset at that time. The case was placed into a human source capacity, and they're attempting to work him and string him into al-Qaeda to see if they can tie him to other people in the military, perhaps, that are tied to al-Qaeda, or use him as a communications hub with this imam in Yemen, who is clearly at the center of gravity here when it comes to terrorist plots.
Yeah, very interesting. I guess I wouldn't be surprised if we get closer to trial that that might end up being part of his defense at some point, that somebody had reached out to him and said, hey, when you know you're heading to the Middle East, you know, keep up that exterior as you being a disgruntled, you know, army major who isn't being treated right by his own, you know, military as a way of getting ingratiating yourself with the people that they can't get human intel on. It would almost seem to explain a lot, but then it comes back to then the larger question. If that's not true, then how do we look at a criteria as a counterterrorism agent? How do you separate out the people that are dangerous and the people who are merely delusional? You know, some guy thinks he's important enough to whip off a letter and email to somebody, but he's not really dangerous. Or somebody that does something like that, and you look at that and go, wait, we have to stop this person before they act now.
Well, you do what exactly took place in New York with this recent plot where you do a tremendous amount of surveillance on the suspects that were engaged there with wiretaps, listening devices. Or you do what was done here recently in Dallas, where you introduce an undercover agent, and that's what you have to try to do. I just find it hard to believe, knowing how the FBI operates and knowing from being on the inside of these counterterrorism investigations, that somebody as serious as Hassan was not opened and was not aggressively pursued. Look, Ian, this is why we created the Joint Terrorism Task Forces. And another interesting aspect here, which a lot of the media has not picked up on, is that this case is being investigated by Defense Criminal Investigative Service. The FBI's role has been purely support, and they also have a parallel intelligence case opened. But this is a fairly clean-cut murder case. It's very simple to prosecute. You've got the killer, you've got the victims. It happened on a military base, so you really don't have to drag in all this dirty laundry on the terrorism aspect.
Right.
And you don't have to deal with highly classified information and so forth as to the sources and methods of how he first came to our attention.
All right, fair enough. Interesting. Let's get a couple of people on this. We're talking about the shooting at Fort Hood. What could have been done to stop it? What do we learn from this as our future lesson? Hugh is on a wild card line in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, on Coast to Coast. Hugh, you're talking with I'm sorry. You know what? I do that. I'm connected. Hugh, you're talking with Fred Burton. Go ahead. All right. Now,
This is a little different, but I hope Ian will let me ask this because I'm very angry and very concerned about it, and your guest may be the one to answer it once and for all. Was there anything in the Communist Manifesto many years before George W. Bush was elected that indicated that the American election system was changing, that it would soon become a pre-designated system? For example, in 2004, the Democratic Elections Investigation Subcommittee subpoenaed both Alaska and Ohio, their governors, and they got the paper ballots indicating that Senator John Kerry had won both states, not the incumbent. So in 2000.
Wait, Hugh, you got to help me understand. How is this going to relate to the topic of counterterrorism?
Well, was this terrorism that we're experiencing today and yesterday, was it involved in the Communist Manifesto?
I'm not sure I understand what you mean by how that is, but I'll get to Fred on that. So, Fred, do we have a blueprint for anything that's going on today, terrorism-wise, from the old days of the Cold War or from what communism thought would be their way of overtaking the rest of the world?
I don't see any direct nexus to Fort Hood in relation to that. I do know that the Russians were very active back before the fall of the wall with the training of terrorist organizations such as the Red Army Faction, the Italian Red Brigades, and the Black September organization. But I don't see any nexus currently.
Well, you know, we talked last week about the Muslim Mafia. We talked about CARE, the Council on Arab American Islamic Relations, and how in many cases this is appears to be sort of a front organization for the Muslim Brotherhood and for other terrorist leaning groups or actors in the United States. Do you have any thought on that?
I think when you start looking at these organizations, that really poses a challenge for the U.S. intelligence community. Usually what you try to do is investigate individuals that are linked to terrorism and not organizations. However, you do like to look at some of these organizations that surface primarily in the so-called charity field where money is being transferred. And that's extraordinarily difficult to track down, especially money leaving the United States and trying to follow the different banks it falls into and so forth.
You know, I'm curious about that because there does seem to be that kind of a blueprint in the out and available for the world to see in the idea of people who are trying to bring about a radical change in the religious orientation of the West. And so that would seem to be a way to do that is to keep creating unrest or distrust or try to work from within and have shootings like this. Are you worried or how is the Army going to respond to this kind of a future threat from people who are, you know, the Army is interested in seeing it have a lot more native Arab speakers so that they can use Arabic in interrogation and they can do more with, you know, the Arabic that they're going to be intercepting through satellite intelligence, et cetera. How do you begin to find out who are the people that can be trusted and who are the plants, who are the people that you might be sending in to create terror somewhere down the road?
It poses a very unique counterintelligence problem. When you start to try to do a national security background investigation, you have a difficult time tracking down family members. You have to knock on a lot of doors. You have to talk to a lot of people. And it really is a challenge just from your basic background investigative process. And then as well as your update investigative process, let's not lose sight of the fact that Major Hassan, you know, had a clearance. He had access to classified information, although he was a psychiatrist. So doing a update on an individual like that is very, very challenging. And that's one of the issues that I think that eventually Congress will get to. How did he develop and why was he allowed to operate for so long in this environment? And that's why I keep coming back to the only thing that makes sense to me is that the FBI was trying to pitch him and turn him.
Or already had, and they just underestimated him. It's Tom, east of the Rockies in Washington on Coast to Coast for Fred Burton, author of Ghost, Confessions of a Counterterrorism Agent. Tom?
Hello, Ian. Great pleasure to talk to you the first time. Good evening, Fred. Fred, I'd like to thank you for your service to our country. I know under the leadership of Greg Bujak and Clark Dittmer, you had a lot on your hands there.
Oh, why, thank you so much.
Yes. Fred, just a quick question. What is the role of TSCM in this latest issue on counterterrorism?
I don't know what that is. Could you explain those initials?
TSCM.
Right. What does that mean, Fred?
Technical security countermeasures. Okay. I think you raise a very good point, Tom. I think when you look at this, we're going to have to start looking at the aspect of how we do surveillance, detection, looking for listening devices, intercept kind of equipment. When it comes to an individual like Major Hassan, especially when we start thinking about him in nexus to his relationship with this imam in Yemen, as to how they communicated back and forth, and the use of electronic intercept equipment and so forth. I mean, we have absolutely no idea as to whether or not Major Hassan was accessing information and passing it back through to the imam in Yemen and or to others associated with al-Qaeda.
And yet, then, again, it comes back to, as a counterterrorism agent, what's your hope? What's your model for being able to get information? You mentioned human intelligence before, and we're talking about technical information. What's our best bet to be able to stop an agency, you know, like al-Qaeda from finding people that are willing to do their bidding here, or for people just, you know, doing it entirely on their own, just kind of following it along, you know, like this guy, Major Hassan, might have done, just kind of enterprising it on their own?
I look at it as a two-pronged problem, Ian. We need to keep our technology edge, our ability to monitor those individuals like Major Hassan that are communicating in the various jihadi chat rooms that have a dialogue with individuals that are of record. And then you get back to the Achilles heel of the intelligence business is the lack of human intelligence. You need someone close to these individuals. You need someone in these jihadi groups that are telling you exactly what they're doing. Look, the technology did not fail here. We intercepted the communications. We knew who Major Hassan was. The failure was the ability to evaluate exactly what Major Hassan was up to at that time. And so, again, if you look at these kinds of disasters, it's been my experience going back to the old days, they usually fail for two reasons. One, the lack of human intelligence, and two, the failure of tactical analysis. Meaning you collect the pieces of the puzzle, but you don't know where the pieces of the puzzle fit.
Okay. Well, we will be watching. What do you think we ought to look for? This is a question I posed to the co-author of The Muslim Mafia a couple of weeks ago. As you look ahead in the news, what are some of the I told you so moments that you think we could expect, that you hope that somebody is out in front of but may not be?
I think for the most part, again, the FBI is doing a good job. 10 plots this year, one actual attack with Fort Hood, and then, of course, we had the Little Rock National Guard shooting, which was another horrendous event. I think as we look at this challenge, what we need to stay focused on is the ability of the U.S. intelligence, specifically the Joint Terrorism Task Force, develop human assets into these organizations, and then we also have to keep our technology edge to stay ahead of these individuals that are communicating in these chat rooms.
I'm going to have you refocus that question, though, here. It, looking ahead at news headlines, if we don't do that, if the FBI doesn't get a lockdown on everything, what do you anticipate will be an attack, a terrorist attack? What will it look like, say, in the next couple of years? What are you anticipating they might be able to get away with if we're not on our A game?
I think you're going to see attacks on mass transportation systems such as the subways in New York City or Washington, D.C., or the Amtrak shuttle that runs between Washington and New York.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate that. A man who knows a little bit about this, Ghost, Confessions of a Counterterrorism Agent. Thank you, Fred Burton. You can link up to Fred through coasttocoastam.com. Family of Secrets. Where did this money come from for all of these CIA secret ops? Did it all come from the taxpayers? Or could there be another source? We'll talk about that, too, coming up with Russ Baker. You're going to find this story fascinating next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.